All right. Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for coming. It's great to be here at the HOPE Conference for another year, for another 2 years, really. My name is Kurt Opsahl. I'm the Deputy Executive Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I'm here with my colleague, Bill Bunnington. And we're here to talk to you about crossing the border, in particular about doing so while protecting your digital devices. So we'll start out with a little stage setting. You know, why is this important? Why do we care about digital devices at the border? I imagine most people in this room have some pretty good reasons to care, but let's just go over some of them. One is that with modern smartphones and laptops, pretty much the entirety of your life is on there, at least the life for the last 10, 15 years. It will have your emails, your photos, your medical records. You're doing more and more things with your computer, and those things are either on your computer or accessible in the cloud through your computer, or metadata that remains on your computer. So it is like a window into your soul. And this is not just about your overall privacy interest, but there are actually some legally recognized privileges which may be in play on a typical laptop. You might have something attorney-client privilege if you communicated with a lawyer, doctor-patient privilege when you're for your medical records. If you're a reporter, there might be privileged information concerning the sources for news articles. And if that information is obtained directly from your device, it's hard to ensure that you'll be able to take appropriate action to remove that from the government. So we're talking mostly about borders. Borders are kind of special places, and it's of course they're the obvious definition of border, where you know the one country meets another. We have a picture here of the U.S.-Mexico border, but legally, borders have a much more broad concept. So here in the United States, the border zone is considered to be anything within 100 miles of a border, which turns out to be where most people live. Because, of course, the ocean is a border, so everybody up and down the west and east coasts are on a border. In addition, any international airport is a border. So even if the airport is in the middle of the country, if you're coming in there from another country, you are at the border. And there's some unusual ones. Sometimes the border is in the departure country, where they have go through customs on the departure. But a lot of these places can be considered the border. And the governments assert more power and authority to search devices at the border. The border is special. They're controlling what comes in and out of the country. Now, traditionally, this has been making sure people aren't smuggling like drugs or weapons or such through the border. But now that people carry their lives in their pocket, there's a lot more that they can reach. But this is not above human rights law. Here in the United States, we have the Fourth Amendment, constitutional protection against unreasonable searches and seizures, as well as other things like the Fifth Amendment, which gives you rights to due process. And then throughout the world, there's also the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which protects your interest in privacy, and many other countries will have constitutional provisions, or the European Union has human rights treaties. So these things will still apply even if it's at a border. So when you come into the United States, they may ask a number of things. They may ask you to unlock your device, to provide your device password so they can unlock it. They may ask about your social media handles so they can look up what you've said, at least what you've said publicly. If you are a U.S. citizen, they can ask these questions, but they can't deny entry if you refuse to answer them. If you're a U.S. permanent resident, they can't deny you entry, but the fact that you refused might cause issues with your status, especially if you wanted to go from a green card holder to get citizenship. And if you are a visa holder, if you don't have that either permanent residency or citizenship, if you fail to cooperate in a way that they like, they can say goodbye, turn around, and send you on back home. So that puts a lot of pressure on people to be cooperative at the border. And device searches are going up. There's a massive increase, 5 times increase between 2015 and 2016. And then between 2016 and 17, pretty massive increase, not as much as the 5 times increase, but 30% is still going up pretty large. So they're happening more and more often, but I don't want to get scared too much. It's still very unlikely. You have like a 1 in 13,000 chance based on raw numbers. But the thing is, it isn't based on raw numbers. It's not just random. So they do a number of things designed to try and figure out who they should give to extra scrutiny. So the Department of Homeland Security started doing what's called extreme vetting, which is collecting information about your online public persona. And then if they see anything interesting in that, the Customs and Border Patrol can ask you questions about that as you're crossing the border and see if they like the answers. And this was in place for a while for immigrant visas, focusing on whether someone should be able to immigrate and become a long-term resident of the United States and not for tourist visas. But this is expanding. The Department of State has proposed to collect social media identifiers, phone numbers, email addresses over the last 5 years from all visa applicants. So this ends up being they have 700,000 immigrant visa applicants and 14 million non-immigrant visa applications. So they're doing a lot of data gathering. And then they use something called the automated targeting system as a decision support tool to decide whether or not to give extra scrutiny. They do risk assessments. And one thing as well is if you are searched at the border, if they do take device data, that data may be integrated into the databases that work with the automatic targeting system. And you will not get specific notice if that happens. They've provided general notice on the middle of a very long document, which was their privacy impact assessment. So under case law in the U.S., there's two standards. There's routine searches and non-routine searches. So for routine searches, this is like looking through your bag, something that is not particularly invasive. They don't need to do individualized suspicion. They can just do it by virtue of being at the border. And then non-routine searches need this extra level, this individualized suspicion, why they need to search you in particular above all the other people who are going through the border. And these are for highly intrusive searches where it impacts your dignity in a particularly offensive manner. So like a body cavity search would sort of clearly fall into that category. But there has come to the question is, okay, we have these standards, but how do they apply to your digital devices? So we have a bit of a circuit split. And to explain what a circuit split, I must first explain what circuits are. The appeals courts in the U.S. are divided into 11 circuits, 1 through 11, and then there's one for D.C. and then a federal circuit that generally does patent law. And in two of those, the 4th and 9th circuit, for a forensic search, for sort of a deep dive into your device, they found that it does require that extra level of suspicion. While in the 11th Circuit, which is down in the southeast corner of the map there, they upheld a forensic search without any suspicion of wrongdoing. So for the 9th, which is basically the West Coast going in as far as Montana, and the 4th, which is Virginia to South Carolina on the East Coast, you do get extra protections. 11th, you don't. The other ones, well, we'll have to find out what they ultimately decide, which side of the split they will go on. And often when there is a circuit split, the Supreme Court ends up resolving it. And we've had a number of good cases over the last couple of years that have suggested that the Supreme Court is becoming more aware of how invasive it is to search devices. A couple years back in Riley versus California, they found that a warrant was required to do a search of a mobile phone. And the case was about search incident to arrest. So this is when they would ordinarily be looking for, see if you like a pocket knife in your pocket. And they said that, well, if we can look for a pocket knife, we can also look through a phone and see all the stuff that's on it. And the court was like, no, that's not the same. And then more recently this year, there was a Supreme Court case, U.S. v. Carpenter, that was about GPS tracking. And again, the court found that a warrant was required and in the discussion gave some support for Riley. So there seems to be at least a pretty good trend in Supreme Court Fourth Amendment jurisprudence on the court recognizing that it is more invasive to look inside a phone, inside your device, than it might be to look in your pocket or to have a officer physically follow you around. And then one case that we're working on at EFF, Al-Assad versus Nielsen, we are challenging the constitutionality of these warrantless searches. The government moved to dismiss the case, and in May of this year, the court said, nope, the case gets to continue, so the case is still going on. It'll probably be, you know, these things take time, so we'll have some answers hopefully later on the constitutionality. One of the reasons why this is important is because of the access to your cloud accounts through your phone. So originally, the government took the position that once they got on your phone, they could also get anything the phone could access. And that has been pushed back. So the Customs and Border Patrol is now saying, at least as a matter of policy, they are not going to look at the things that are accessible from your device. Now, this is a difference in methodology. If they wanted to, like, just look on your publicly available tweets, they can still do that. It is whether they're getting it through the device. Another important consideration, legal consideration, when you're crossing is, what is the state of your password? A lot of devices now use your fingerprint as a method of unlocking your phone or computer. And this is super convenient. It adds a ease of use that means that actually a lot of people are now locking things that they might not have locked before because it was too much of a pain to keep on typing in your password. So it's probably a net benefit for security, but it is not a net benefit for your legal resistance to unlocking the device. There are some cases that have found that you don't have the same resistance to being forced to unlock something if it's a fingerprint versus a password. Also keep in mind that while if you're in border custody, they can just grab your finger and put it on the device, and then it's unlocked. And then the government may have records of your fingerprints from other sources, and there have been at least some exploits that have been able to use records of fingerprints to fool a fingerprint reader. So turn a little bit to if you're from the rest of the world and are traveling to the European Union, EU citizens get a minimal check, but for non-EU country nationals, you get thorough checks. So what does that really mean? Well, there's the pre-border checks, and they see if anything like before you even arrive in the country shows that they think you're high risk. And if that happens, they'll go to a more intensive review. And then they'll also do a first-line check through the documents, ask you a few questions. And then if there's something they find funny about the answers to those questions, you might get a second-line check, and that's where there might be a device search. They are fairly rare, but they still happen, and there's a lot of differences. Here's a chart showing various EU airports, and you can see that Charles de Gaulle was much more enthusiastic about it than Frankfurt. This data is from 2012, so that may have changed. Basically, if there are some communication difficulties, if they see any mismatches between their databases and your published documents, you'll probably get more thorough scrutiny. In the EU, it's the national law that defines what the scope of the permissible search is, so it will vary by country to country, though there are some baselines, and the EU Agency for Fundamental Rights has said that the purpose needs to be things like verifying your identity, your nationality, looking for dangerous objects, searching for criminal things. So it has to at least be cabined within that. In the United Kingdom, which for the time being is in the EU, but will be out soon, they have a Schedule 7 of the Terrorism Act, which gives them superpowers at the border to detain people for hours without a right to remain silent. So here in the US, there is a right to remain silent, not so much in the United Kingdom. This has been challenged a couple times. There was someone who refused to hand over passwords at the border, was arrested for this, and earlier this year argued the appeal, and we'll wait on that decision. But there have been some preliminary decisions that have suggested that they shouldn't be able to demand the passwords, but nevertheless, they still are sometimes doing that. Elsewhere in the Commonwealth, Canada claims the power to examine your devices without a warrant to ask for your passwords. The Canadian courts have not yet ruled on this, so it remains unclear whether this will ultimately be upheld. Australia also claims to have a right to demand your passwords. And then just a moment to talk about some authoritarian regimes like China or Russia. And I'm not going to do like a deep analysis here. I think if you're going to those countries, probably you're not going to be able to use the legal system to protect yourself. And you should expect that if they do ask, you'll pretty much I'll seize your device and give you a real hard time if you don't cooperate. So this is where we might suggest you take the maximum precautions. And so what are those maximum precautions? How do we know what to do? Well, we look at threat models. So you have to think, first of all about you. What is your citizenship? What is your residence? Travel history? One of the more important things is, what is your tolerance for hassle and delay? If you want to make it more difficult to search your device at the border, then they will make your life more difficult in return. And so you have to, you know, make a decision about how much of that you want to deal with. And also whether you want to make a statement. Do you want to make a political statement about how you feel about privacy of devices and put up resistance? That may be a good statement to get into the news, but you'll have to be dealing with the consequences. Another aspect of threat modeling, think about your data. How bad would it be if they got a hold of this data? Do you need to have it when you're in the other country? If you do need to have it, can you get it over a network, or will the networks there be insufficient to restore your devices from backup? So you have to look at sort of these factors in deciding what best to go forward with. So as you arrive at the border, well, before you even get to the border, you want to, if you're carrying any work devices, talk to your employer about it, and then think about, well, I might lose this device. This might be a good time to do some backups, encrypt what you can, use strong passwords. If you have devices that automatically log in to cloud services, you can erase the password to those services so that if someone does get onto your device, they have to ask you for another password to go any further than that. Log out, remove credentials, clear out as much as you can. And most importantly, don't bring it. The strongest protection against getting your device searched is to not have it. So you just leave devices at home, use a temporary device, delete data that you won't need. And if you really need the data, consider moving it to the cloud and then re-downloading it after you're past the border. Have the security be your strength of your VPN or the encryption you use, putting it up and down. And then once you get to the border, well, first plan ahead. Have an idea of what you're going to do under various circumstances. They ask for a device, if they ask for a password, how you're going to respond. When you are responding, be polite and respectful. You can still refuse to do things, but do so politely. Don't lie to the border agent. Lying to an officer is a crime here in the U.S. It's a federal crime. And the penalty to that can be actually more severe than a lot of the penalties for things that might come up from what's on the device. And it gives them an extra point of leverage. So lying may actually end up hurting you far more than what you might be covering up by the lie. If they start to search your devices, don't physically interfere. You don't want to add any additional charges to this. Just document everything that happens. Who are they? What's their badge number? What agency are they working for? What time did it occur? So that if you want to do something about it later, you'll have that information. Be careful about consent. So if someone asks you a question like, do you mind if I take a look at your device? That is not just a sort of a polite way of saying hand over the device, that will be interpreted as asking for your consent. And so you might need to clarify, is that an order? Are you requiring me to hand this over, or is that a request? And if it's a request, you say, well, then I say no. And if it's an order, well, then you have to make some choices. You can choose to comply with the order and then hand over device and look at your legal options later for cases to try to say that was unconstitutional, have them erase your data and so on, but your legal options will be more limited. Or you can refuse to comply, which will escalate the event. It may result in the device getting seized, put things onto your record so that the next time you go through a border, they will see that you were uncooperative previously, but you will preserve your legal options to fight for that information not to be revealed. And then finally, once you get past the border, if there's been some sort of incident, document everything. Write down anything that had happened. If they required you to hand over your passwords, keep in mind that they will keep a record of that and may use those passwords again. So if you had to hand over any passwords, change them immediately so that they are no longer in use, even though they've been in use just the one time. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Bill, talk to you about technological measures.
Thanks very much, Kurt. Yeah, so as Kurt mentioned, the number one thing that you can do is not to bring your device with you. If you don't have your device with you, there's no data that they can get off of it. In addition, you can have bring a temporary device. That can be useful because if you have a temporary device, you don't have your social media accounts and other accounts logged into that device, so they can't get data off of that. And if you choose to bring your device anyway, then you should be aware that there are some technological measures that you can use to protect yourself if you do it right. So just to get into some of the technological capabilities of border agents and border patrols, this is a slide from Cellebrite. Cellebrite is a forensic analysis company based in Israel. They advertise right on their website that they work globally in hundreds of different countries, working with law enforcement, intelligence services, and indeed border patrols as well. What Cellebrite does is they have you either send in your device to their lab or have a local device available to unlock your Android phone via the JTAG interface, or you know, in their lab, they will provide a way to unlock iOS devices. This is a report that's generated from Cellebrite software. You can see that there are call logs, your location, your SMS and MMS messages. One of the important things to look at here is on the right side of these columns, it even is able to retrieve deleted items. And we'll go into a little bit later how to ensure that those deleted items are actually really deleted. One competitor that came up in the news a lot this year is a company called Grayshift. They're an Atlanta-based forensic company that advertise very heavily on how to unlock iOS 9, 10, and 11 devices. What they do is a law enforcement agency is interested in unlocking iOS devices locally, and they'll ask Grayshift for a Graykey device, and Grayshift will send back a device that looks like this. And then the local law enforcement will plug in your iOS device. It'll upload some software onto it in order to start a password cracking brute force attempt. And once that brute force attempt is successful, you plug it back into the device and it generates a report. These are available in the $15,000 and $30,000 levels. And that differs from Cellebrite in that for iOS devices, the law enforcement agents get a local copy of this device. Grayshift's customers include some of the large Fortune 500 companies, local and federal law enforcement, and a lot of this has been reported in Forbes. And they've been doing great journalism over this. But you know, with all these law enforcement agents, you might wonder who's watching you now. The IRS? And indeed, the IRS is watching you. You know, the IRS purchased one of the $15,000 level gray key devices as well. So you can assume that based on their customer base, border patrols and border agents, I wouldn't be surprised if they're using this as well. This is one of the world-renowned cryptographers, Matthew Green, speculating on how long it will take to crack your passcode at different levels. If you have a six-digit code, then it won't take very long to crack that. And as you add a few digits onto it, it's much harder. So you might want to, you know, upgrade that six-digit code if you have one. Apple's response to all this was last week, just introducing a thing called USB restricted mode, which turns off the Thunderbolt data and just makes it a dumb charging port for your iOS device if you haven't unlocked the iOS device in the last hour or so. And you can see the UX workflow that indicates that you have this turned on at the bottom there. So I think the most important thing you should take away for protecting your device is making sure that device encryption, full disk encryption, is turned on for both your mobile and desktop devices as you cross the border. This is an extremely powerful mechanism to protect your data. It protects your data at rest, which means that it doesn't protect any data when you're talking to your friends, when you're transferring files, viewing websites. That's all data in transit. This is protecting data at rest when your computer is off and you're trying to decrypt the data that's actually on the device itself. Now, it's important to note that this is actually separate from screen unlock in most cases. This isn't so true for your mobile devices, but it's especially true for desktop and laptop devices. So there's a separate unlock code from your screen unlock. Your screen unlock is different from your full disk encryption passphrase in most cases. iOS has this secure enclave coprocessor that's been in every iOS device since the iPhone 5S and later. And what this device does is it's a dedicated hardware module that every time you enter your PIN, if you enter it wrong, it attempts to throttle the attempt. And so if you enter it wrong, you know, five times, the next attempt that you can give is longer. And then you enter it six times, seven times, each subsequent attempt gets longer. So they can't attempt brute force attacks on your device. And after attempt, then the device locks down completely and you can't unlock it. The way that this works is that your PIN is entangled with two sources of key material. One is from a UID that's baked into the secure enclave at manufacture time, and then a GID, which you flash into the device, and you can reflash, but it won't exfiltrate any of that data. It won't give out the bits of key material if you query for that. So this is extremely exfiltration-resistant hardware. But presumably, this is actually bypassable by Graykey and Cellebrite software using 0 days that they have not obviously disclosed. So in any case, it's extremely important that you choose a good passphrase for any disk encrypted device that you have. Strong passwords are extremely critical for disk encryption. With modern hardware, trillions of guesses can be made using complex word lists and combinatorics. So what we recommend is using five or six random words, and this can be extremely effective against dictionary-based attacks. In addition, our brains are wired to really create stories, weave stories when we have five or six random words, as can be illustrated by the XKCD comic correct horse battery staple. You can weave that story very easily. In addition, you can look up at eff.org/dice, the Diceware password generation methodology that can be useful in generating passwords. So in disk encryption for mobile OS support is pretty widely available in general. Android has had it for a long time, but full support in Android devices only came about as of Android 6, and only if Google apps are enabled. AOSP is an open source operating system. You can implement it however you want, but if Google apps are enabled, there's a contractual obligation with Google to make sure that full disk encryption can be enabled. For iOS devices, full disk encryption has been available for a very long time, since iPhone 3S and later, 3GS and later. For the desktop OSs, Windows has BitLocker, which is a Microsoft Windows piece of software that's built into the operating system. There's also Veracrypt, which is a fork of the TrueCrypt deprecated software that's been available since 2013. Mac OS has File Vault 2, and in the latest versions of Mac OS, even gives you a prompt when you install the operating system in order to enable File Vault 2. And Linux, to much props, has had it since the mid-2000s available. Some important usage tips, though, is don't forget your password when you're enabling full disk encryption, because some tools, like BitLocker, will allow you to back up your password with Microsoft. You need to be really careful and really aware of the fact that Microsoft then has full access to those files if requested. But in general, you need to really remember your password in order to unlock that device if you're not backing it up with a cloud servers. Just turn off your fingerprint unlock. As Kurt mentioned earlier, Border Agent can simply take your finger and unlock the device very easily. But better than, you know, removing your fingerprint unlock every time you cross a border, what you can do is simply turn off the device when you cross the border. And then once you turn it on again, your full disk encryption passphrase will be prompted and you can't unlock it simply with your finger. So you can turn it off before you go through the border. And then once you get through the border, turn it back on. So you'll be prompted for that passphrase again. And then once you boot into your operating system, the fingerprint unlock will work again. So if you don't have full disk encryption enabled on your device, you can use secure deletion to get files off of your device. You don't have to be as fastidious as Elliot and Mr. Robot and put all your hard drives in a microwave to make sure that that data is deleted. There are tools that let you do this. What's important to know here is that simple deletion, just simply removing files from your hard drive, isn't enough. What simple deletion does is it simply erases the demarcation of, like, this is a file on my hard drive, but doesn't actually erase the data that that file contained in the first place. Now, border agents have sophisticated forensic tools that might be available depending on the border crossing that you're at, but this really doesn't require any sophisticated tools at all. Undeleting files is a simplistic operation that you yourself can do at home. So secure deletion should be used and can be used to overwrite the individual bits where a file was allocated and erase those typically with zeros. Factory reset, when you hear that term, this may or may not securely delete data. It depends on your operating system, and it also depends on whether or not you have full disk encryption enabled in the first place. It also, if you have like an SD card connected to your device, that will not be erased from factory reset. It only erases the internal drives. So that's an important caveat to be aware of. With solid-state drives and USB flash drives, SSDs, memory cards, it may or may not securely delete files. The reliability of secure deletion is questionable because of something called wear leveling. Wear leveling is where the writes on the SSD are kind of spread across the SSD in order to eliminate the possibility of bad sectors. But this is controlled by the SSD's the firmware, so this is not apparent to the operating system. So the operating system won't actually know if it's been overridden successfully or not. There are some kind of ways that you can come close. You can look into trim with deterministic zero overwrites to see whether you get pretty close, but that's not quite as good as on a spinning disk secure deletion. With formatting, formatting means really two things. It could be a quick format, which will not actually delete data, the actual data from that device. It won't securely delete. If you are looking into low-level formatting, secure formatting, that actually will delete the data that you want deleted. Some tools. On Linux and Windows, you have BleachBit. And BleachBit both deletes files and free space, and it also deletes little things that you might forget about. Like, you know, for instance, your web browsing history, recent documents, etc. It's imperfect. It might not get every single thing that you leave on your device, but it does a pretty good job, and that's available both on Linux and Windows. And macOS has RM-P since older tools have been deprecated. But if you actually have secure, if you have full disk encryption enabled on your device, then it's much easier. You can actually erase all the data in a way that makes it unreadable simply by wiping the copy of the decryption key that is on that device. This functionality is actually built into iOS devices via the factory reset that I talked about earlier. It may or may not delete on other operating systems, but that actually does mean secure deletion on iOS devices. And on power, it's called PowerWash on Chromebooks. So just kind of keep in mind that this might be called different things on different platforms. In Linux, you can erase that Lux decryption slot in order to do secure deletion. Moving on to Trusted Boot. Trusted Boot is a way that you can actually ensure the trusted boot process from pre-boot to a way that's verifiable by the operating system itself. and verify basically that your boot process hasn't been tampered with by that nasty border agent that you are afraid of. This actually requires a separate trusted platform module in your machine or equivalent. And this is done by a step-by-step boot verification process, signing the boot process and verifying it. One really interesting implementation of this is called the Trusted Platform Module Time-Based One-Time Password, TPM TOTP. This was demonstrated by Tremel Hudson in his project Heads. And this is kind of what it looks like. When you boot your operating system, you get a one-time password, which you can then verify using Google Authenticator or the like. I thought that was a really neat implementation of secure boot, or trusted boot, I should say. Trusted boot is also available in mobile devices on iOS for a long while. On Android devices, it's called Verified Boot. It uses the Trusted Environment Engine on devices that support it. But what's important to keep in mind here is that it's only really available on two major Android operating systems. But one is stock Android, and the other is Copperhead OS, although there's been some hacker drama recently with Copperhead OS, so the future of that platform is somewhat uncertain. One important thing is that it is actually not available on Lineage OS. So if you have a custom ROM that you're flashing onto your device, you will not get the support of Trusted Boot. Desktops, Windows 8 has this thing called Secure Boot. It is not Trusted Boot. It's a UEFI standard, and it's not meant to be Trusted Boot. It's good against remote attackers, but it actually won't help you in the local attacker context where you're at the border, worried about a border agent changing your boot process. Linux has, in some configurations, Trusted Boot, and Chromebooks have had it in the form of Verified Boot since the very earliest Chromebooks, and it's gotten better and better against local attacks. Mac OS has, of 2018, MacBook Pros have a T2 chip that allows for Trusted Boot. And also some iMacs also have Trusted Boot. But in the border context, it might be really kind of hard to travel with, unless you're very audacious. For cloud storage, if you're traveling across the border, you really want to minimize the amount of data, sensitive files that are on your device in the first place, so that if they do the Cellebrite or Greeky attack and get your data, you won't have much on it of use. Cloud storage is often something that we don't recommend in the case of a domestic situation. If you're inside a border, often the power subpoena is able to get those files anyway. But if you're at the border, as Kurt mentioned, border agents will not necessarily have any authority to get at your cloud data. So we recommend doing cloud storage in order to do this data minimization process as you cross the border. Offloading content is also very powerful against theft. If you're traveling on vacation and you have your computer stolen, then you'll have at least your data backed up in the cloud. But of course, there is no cloud. There's just other people's computers. So there comes with cloud storage some risks. Your data can be accessed by governments with the power of subpoena. Hackers can gain access to cloud servers through hacking the cloud servers themselves. And of course, most cloud services don't actually do, they only encrypt your data in transit. They don't actually encrypt your data when it's sitting on the servers that they have access to. So there's this thing called client-side encryption, which you can do with cloud services. Some services offer this service, which actually encrypts your files before it's ever uploaded to the the cloud in the first place. This is also called zero knowledge in the industry. It's different from what's called zero knowledge in cryptography a bit. So there's a kind of dissonance of terminology here. But it protects you against those nasty government snoopers and hackers that are trying to get at your data. One important thing to note with this is that Well, you need to have your key material available and remember your password if you ever want to get that data again. So make sure that you back up that in a reliable way. And here are some services that do and don't offer client-side encryption. On the left, you'll see Spider Oak and Trezorit and others. But on the right, those that do not offer it are the most popular services that you might be used to using, iCloud, Google Drive. So you might need to search out one of the solutions on the left if you are curious about doing client-side encryption. So some of the takeaways from this is the best defense, again, is to not bring your device with you at all. If you have to bring your device with you, use full disk encryption and look into if your device supports trusted boot. And combining these methods with a process of data minimization can offer some powerful protections in the border context. Thanks very much. And moving on to questions.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is there any evidence that the lack of data or lack of social media accounts or lack of what have you at the border can also be treated, has been treated or will be treated as suspicious?
I think it certainly could be that in this sort of modern era, it is rare that someone would have no social media presence. I mean, if you don't have one, it is, of course, said, lying to a border agent can get you into more trouble. So saying that you don't have one when you do could be a problem. But yeah, they probably will think it funny if you say, no, I don't do it whatsoever.
Do you have recommendations for specific language to use to determine whether a request for access to your device is an order versus a request you can deny?
I think just be very, very straightforward. Is that a request, or are you ordering me to do that? I mean, politely, respectfully, not combatively, but, am I required to comply? It's sort of like when you get stopped and you say, am I free to leave? If you ever get stopped by the police, you should actually ask that question. Am I free to go? And if they say yes, then go. So, yeah, you just straight up ask the question.
Kurt, do you know whether, so when you get pulled into secondary in the foreign country, which happens to me all the time these days, and you are considered a priority secondary screening for the screening in the foreign country and you get your hand swabbed and all that rot, do you know what the process of that bureaucratically between TSA and people in the United States are? Does that serve a purpose other than swabbing your hands, which I suspect it does, and I'm wondering if you know?
So I don't have the generic details on that. I'm aware that for some countries, such as the EU, they have worked out some data sharing agreements as between the two countries. There's some tensions there because EU is a little bit strict on privacy issues. But they have worked out some deals in order to share passenger data. So it may well be that the fact of the stop or the secondary screening would be shared. And then also if something came up such that they thought this was pertinent to some investigations and dove deeper, that could also be shared.
Yeah, I actually think one of the things they're doing is bringing you into secondary overseas so that somebody domestically gets triggered so they know that you're checking in for a flight overseas.
And so one of the things that, the U.S. is a part of the Five Eyes, which are Canada, New Zealand, Australia, United Kingdom, and the USA. And they have extensive intelligence sharing. And they all say, oh, we don't spy on our own citizens. This is a foreign intelligence kind of thing. But, yeah, each one can spy on the other citizens and then share the data. So there are definitely loopholes like that.
My question is, do you have recommendations for bringing encryption keys across borders, say for decrypting stuff you have stored in cloud storage or restoring your TPM configurations, other than just memorizing passwords for them?
One thing that you can do is actually just not have that memorized and have a friend you know, actually have, or a few friends have access to that key material. And then once you get, you actually cross the border, then you can call them up or contact them in some secure way in order to reconstitute that passphrase. That might be a truthful way to say, I don't actually have the key material to unlock this device.
Okay, and then I had one other thing to mention. When you were talking about cloud storage, there's a service, or there's a tool you can use called Arclone, which provides a fuse mounting layer and an encryption layer for a lot of unencrypted cloud storage providers.
Thank you.
Hello. So I had a specific question about what you were talking about regarding turning your phone off and disabling fingerprint reader. So I train activists sometimes, and what I usually tell them is to, on iOS devices specifically, when you click the power button 5 times, it disables the fingerprint reader and it forces you to put in a password. My question is there any difference in terms of the ability of a forensic method to get past that between that method where you're, you know, hitting the power button 5 times to disable the fingerprint reader and when you are actually restarting the phone directly after the boot sequence?
One thing to know about SOS mode when we were testing this is that when you go into SOS mode by hitting the button 5 times, it starts a call to local law enforcement as well. So it might, depending on your audience, not you might not want to do that, just depending on like what their threat model is. But addressing the question directly, can you repeat that? Sorry.
Yeah. So just, is there any difference in terms of the ability of a forensic method to get past the SOS mode when you're disabling fingerprint versus when the device itself restarts and it prompts you when the device starts initially in boots to type in your passcode?
So I believe, and I'm not sure about this, but I believe that going into SOS mode actually enables USB restricted mode as well. And so the Thunderbolt port will be disabled from data transfer, which will disable things like direct memory access to the operating system, which should protect you well. I think that if you really want to be sure, I think that turning off the device is better, but I don't see how it would be much better.
I would add, though, if you're in a border context, if you get to the screening person and they start to ask you some questions, and you pull out your phone, you go whap 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 on the SOS mode, that's not going to go well with them. They're going to think that is very suspicious. So if you have it instead in your bag and it's off, and you're like, yeah, I didn't want the battery to go, you don't have to lie or anything. But like, don't make a scene of turning out. Now, it might be other circumstances in which, like, that is your best option, but keep in mind that is an escalation.
Thank you.
Hi. I have a question in regards to in connection to the first question we had, so in social media, can I be forced to give up my password for my social media account? And also, do we know of examples of that? And specifically, also what we heard, I could maybe ask a friend to keep my password or something. If I'm not a citizen, they could probably just say, like, either give me the password or we don't let you in.
That's absolutely right. If you are not a citizen, or in some cases like a lawful permanent resident, there are some other categories where they do have to let you in. But if you are, you know, on a tourist visa, you know, going to visit a country in a country where you don't have a absolute right to be there, then it's just like, yeah, give me your social media password. You're like, no. And they're like, okay, goodbye. And so you've protected your account, like, so you got that going for you. But, this is that's on the sort of the high end of dealing with a lot of hassle and delay. And it also may be circumstances, in some countries where this might be in a, you get detained and such. On the other hand, most of the circumstances that I'm aware of hasn't been asking for the social media password. It's asking for the device password and then going through the apps using the stored password on the device to look further. So having it require that additional password in those circumstances may be that additional barrier.
Okay, thank you.
Last question. Hi. So you might recall in late 2016, there was the letter that my former colleagues at Freedom Press, along with 150 prominent filmmakers and photographers, sent to camera manufacturers to urge them to add encryption capability to, you know, video cameras and photo cameras. From what I understand, they've completely resisted this, and they don't think that there's a market for it. So that puts a lot of people in quite a predicament, because they either have to transfer that data to an encrypted drive or put it in a cloud somewhere where, you know, it could be a lot of data, so that could be a problem. What are you recommending now for cameras?
So there is this novel idea to use the firmware controller on SD cards, and the SD card firmware controller will be able to have a public key uploaded to it somehow or stored in it somehow. And then the firmware controller itself would encrypt the file when it was stored on the SD card, and then effectively delete the publicly available SD card file. And then once you take it out of the camera and plug it into a computer, you could do some special thing to retrieve those. Actually, sorry. The process is you take the photo, it encrypts it with the public key that was given to it, and then it's stored in secret on the SD card somewhere. I don't think this is actually something that exists, but I think that it would be a great idea for journalists that don't have a camera that enables encryption, but have the right capability on an SD card.
Yeah, they're the odd ones out. It's on our laptop, it's on our phone.
That's it, guys. We've run out of time, but thank you very much, and round of applause for the EFF.
Thank you, everybody. We're going to go down to the EFF booth down the vendor floor. If people have follow-up questions, we can see us down on the mezzanine level.